Welcome to the Culture and Sports Podcast, where we have discussions about how leadership and organizational culture impact organizational success, team and athlete performance, and the short and long-term mental, physical, and emotional health of athletes. The Culture and Sports Podcast is brought to you by Culture and Sports. Culture and Sports helps sports organizations, teams, coaches, support and front office staff, and athletes understand the importance of leadership and organizational culture and its direct impact to success.
Please join Robert Boland and Dr. Jeremy Piasecki in this season of the Culture and Sports Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Season 5 of the Culture and Sports Podcast, where we talk about how leadership and organizational culture impacts organizational success, team and athlete performance, and the short and long-term mental, physical, and emotional health of athletes. I'd like to introduce you to this season's guest co-host, Bob Boland. Bob, how are you doing today?
It's a pleasure to be here, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, can you please tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, well, I think it's a natural. I obviously have worked with you at Culture and Sports for some time. It's been a great joy of my life. Nowadays, I hang out my day job as a law professor at Seton Hall University Law School in New Jersey, in Newark. And I also hang out my shingle at the law firm of Shoemaker, Loop & Kendrick, where I'm of counsel, but I also am at least co-head of their hospitality, sports, and leisure studies, or leisure industries and sports industries practice. So I get to spend some time in the real world, and I get to spend some time in academia, which is always a lot more fun and a lot more joyful for me as a teacher. But you get to be in both worlds, and that's kind of awesome. For 5 years, I had one of the world's most unusual jobs, and it's kind of the natural fit, kind of the epoxy between me and culture and sports. I was the athletic integrity officer at Penn State, helping that university recover from one of the greatest athletic scandals in university history, the Sandusky crisis. That's become something I've studied academically and look at very carefully, both the future of college sports and also how institutions in college are particularly subject to challenges in these areas.
So we recently had our annual leadership summit here for Culture and Sports, and you were very instrumental with getting that going and aligning the best guest speakers possible. I wanted you to kind of explain about the topic of our annual leadership summit and why it's important to you.
Well, I think it's a natural offshoot from everything I've done in my life and career that I would care a great deal about the future of college sports. Naturally, the Penn State assignment really puts that into perspective. But even now at Shoemaker, I do a great deal of work with athletic directors, coaches, athletic departments, entities involved in the NIL space, really working to do the best for them, but also to provide kind of future-focused advice to each of them to avoid the mistakes that happened at Penn State, to avoid the mistakes that have happened in other places where there's been a significant crisis, but also to be nimble and always searching for what the next issue is going to be. And obviously, if you follow college athletics, you know it's in a remarkable state of flux. So the idea of getting together a group of 28 experts and having four panels and talking about the future was a natural part of what we would want to do, both as a thought leader and as almost a guide to different constituencies of culture and sport. The idea that we help shape or at least advise on the legal schema of it, that we help talk about the business practices of it, that we looked at how coaches relate and interact in this current environment, and then finally how parents and athletes, how their role is changing in an era where college athletes are being compensated in a variety of mechanisms.
So at the beginning of our summit, we went into an incredibly difficult topic, and the panel was about the uncertain future of college sports, right? So everything's always uncertain in the future, but especially now. Why is everything so uncertain now at this point in time in collegiate athletics?
You can see it coming for a while. We're not this hasn't really just sprung up on us, but it's reached a point where the legal nature of college sport, what it represents and how the athletes are categorized and what their status is legally, is really very much a jump ball. And the fact that this legal definition that the athletes are pushing for and is changing long held relationships in college sports. I just here at the law school today, I passed a person in the hall who's a Minnesota law grad or a Minnesota grad, and we made a comment and joked about, I can't get used to a Big Ten with 18 teams. on the flip side, somebody made a comment, do you work in name, image, and likeness, and how can these athletes be missing so much class time if they're out promoting themselves? So we've been watching college sports over probably a 30-year arc have a changing relationship to the business of it, and how once it became an $18 or $19 billion business, then a lot of relationships have changed around it, obviously, who the colleges associate with, what conferences they're in, who their peers are, what the divisions and how they compete with each other are aspects. And then once you start to make money, you start to think about maximizing your money. And then mm-hmm. you find out that people are making tens of millions of dollars in an enterprise worth billions of dollars. The players have come in and asked for their fair share. And we're in a long debate over what that fair share might be, how it would get calculated, and what of it they would own. So that's really the moment we're in. And then we're also in a moment where we're debating what form that future will take. Will it take the form of endorsement dollars? Will it take the form of a more professionalized industry where the athletes are employees? Or will it take the form of something that resembles the pro leagues, where the athletes are unionized and give antitrust protection to their employers? So a lot of complex questions, and the fact that we haven't answered a lot of these questions about legal status and the legal nature of college athletics has probably put us at a place where everything's up in the air at once.
Now, with such an uncertain future, there's obviously many different areas that need to adjust, and as human beings, change is not always easy to embrace. It's quite difficult. So, athletes have to go through change, coaches, support staff, athletic directors, NCAA member institutions, conferences, the NCAA themselves, and all sorts of other entities that are involved in college sports. But let's talk about coaches for a second. What are some of the things that you've seen over this past 30-year arc, and do you think you'll continue to see in the future with coaches, not only struggling with embracing and adapting to change, but also some of the positive things that you've seen?
Grit, that's a terrific question. I don't know if there's been a job that's changed more, at least on the outside of that job definition, than being a college coach. Historically, college coaches did principally two things. They coached and they recruited. And because you couldn't coach, you wanted good players to come to your school, so you recruited heavily and you coached. Those were your two jobs. What's happened over the arc of 30 years and really maybe 40, if you think about it, going back to the Board of Regents case where the NCAA lost control of college football and kind of started the money grab that we're in right mm-hmm. now, this professionalizing of our model. Coaches are so much more. The complication of their job is as commercial enterprises to raise money, to sustain their sport, to now to decide how to get players who fit their model both as players, but also as paid potentially players under NIL. And then just the relationship of athlete to institution to coach has undergone a lot of change. The idea that we were once sort of almost blindly loyal to our coaches, and coaches to some degree betrayed that trust, or at least took advantage of that trust to create situations where athletes were more concerned or are very concerned about their future, we've seen a devolution of kind of the sports, the prep sports, to be more club oriented and travel team oriented, to become a business, if you will, at the prep level. So the idea that college coaches who saw loyalty in a college relationship and a recruitment relationship, that's really diminished. And there's a lot less, I won't say that there's less trust, but the trust is less deeply rooted. Trust is less deeply rooted would be the way I'd describe that in my less and more conversation. So it's not that you don't trust your coach. It's not that you and your coach have a bad relationship, but that relationship is no longer blindly trusting or unquestionably trusting. It's now a questioning trust. And that's a tough thing for a lot of coaches. I think the other thing that's changed for coaches is the kind of the diminishment of power in our society. We try not to, or at least over the last 20 years in employment, we've tried not to have power over our employees. We've tried to lead more with a consensus approach where there's much more servant leadership or facilitation leadership. And so sports is one of the true areas where we still use power against people, or power on people maybe is the better way to phrase it, whether to motivate or whether to also in some measure dash hopes and to bring a touch of reality. And that's now very, very hard because it's now much less in step with other aspects of society. So coaches still use power and are using power, probably are under greater scrutiny for the use of that power and not more flexible leadership techniques that enable them to move an athlete forward. I don't think the athlete and coach relationship has changed a whole heck of a lot. If the coach is good and mature, if the athlete is trusting, but we've changed a lot of relationships that support that trust and replace them with ones that make people question that trust. Mm-hmm. And we've also set up other structures around it, whether that's the ability to receive name, image, and likeness money to be compensated while a college athlete, where playing time actually affects how much you earn, how well you're doing economically, not just your draft status or your place on the team. And then we also have added things like the transfer portal where we can look for other deals and other opportunities, which complicates things to some degree. So we've added more variables to the relationship than we had before. And I think that's changed the coaching relationship. I'll add one good thing to the coaching relationship, at least at some schools. Coaches are being paid well. And I say that as a good thing this way. I want everyone to be paid well. That's the first step. Mm-hmm. I want everyone to does important work to get paid for it. And I do believe coaching is very important work. It is the most intense, most dedicated, and maybe the most effective form of mentorship that those of us who play sports get to experience with our coaches. So it's wonderful they're being compensated for it, that these are incredible teachers, they're extraordinary mentors, and that if they're well compensated, we're happy about that. What the bad side that's come with that, in addition to some of that improved compensation, we fire these coaches a lot more often, so we put a lot greater pressure on them to carve a life around the possibility of being fired for, not for a good reason, but for a lack of performance or an underperformance. Often of their athletes, none of them necessarily. And then we also put a lot of pressure externally on our programs as they become businesses. The status of who we are may be affected by the status of our teams and if they're winning. And so rather than thinking about what's right for our school from a holistic standpoint, this kind of professionalized economy has made it a lot more about what's happening in the now. What are my short-term rewards? Am I winning? Am I losing? Am I up and I'm down? And so that's really changed the relationship of the coach to the institution, as well as the relationship to the coach to the athlete. So the bonds are frayed. We have a lot more question in this space. So it's a complicated one here. And coaches need to be highly adaptable, really emotionally intelligent, and understand that athletes don't operate all as one size fits all, that they're motivated differently, and develop that. How do they do that? Through communication, through honesty, through the development of trust and candor and empathy, but not necessarily all at once and not necessarily evenly.
So throughout all this change, and obviously there's always change happening, but especially now in college sports, not only are coaches having to adapt, institutions are, athletic directors are. Before, there was probably less levels of winning than there were, than there are now, right? So I'm sure athletic directors wanted coaches to win, or they wanted to bring the program to a certain level. But now, is it really cut and dry with what winning means and what success means to athletic directors and presidents at universities? Or do you think that's really nebulous and hard to define at this point?
I think it's nebulous, harder to define, and a much higher bar than it used to be. So it could be, if I've answered all your question, it's yes to all of them. Every program thinks that they're going to win national titles and compete at a very high level. The reality is they aren't. It is a very, very high pinnacle to reach, and it takes probably a bit of luck and a lot of historical advantage. Let's say that we have a stratifying system where some can really aspire to that and some can't. Then you have to be able to define what athletics means inside your institution. And we've done a really poor job of that, I think, in the larger model of explaining what college sports means, what participation in it means to the athletes, and then also explaining what we value institutionally from that. Now, university presidents won't tell you this in the way they could, but they value college athletics because it gives them an opportunity for alumni to be centered on something and to develop new alumni who will give it a higher rate. People who like sports tend to want to support their institution, want to support the teams, and the teams become kind of the conduit for that. They're also a conduit for broadcast time, if you think about it. So there is some zero-sum competition to get on television, to get on streaming, to be seen, and to make a name for your institution. They are also they aren't necessarily a pure profit center, but they're a big revenue center. They generate a lot of revenue now. And whether athletic departments are self-sustaining or not quite self-sustaining or operating as pathways to getting more students to come and attend, the idea is they represent a significant investment on behalf of institutions, both in terms of prestige, but also in terms of just annual value. I used to say, without saying it, in a facetious or flippant way, that I was, as athletic integrity officer at Penn State, the person watching over one of the most valuable or the most valuable reputational asset of the university, its athletic program. Now, I don't mean to say that our nuclear science program or the nuclear reactor we had on campus wasn't also equally valuable. I'm not going to say that our patents and medical devices and things that we've invented aren't equally important, or engineering school building bridges and buildings and other things, engineering that hold up in time aren't really valid. But if you think about Penn State, its athletic reputation is one of, if not the first thing, it's one of the first things. So athletics for a lot of institutions, which are the largest employers in their state, as Penn State was, you'll find that a lot of times that asset of the good name of its athletic department is really valuable to the institution. And in some cases, it needs to be protected, or in every case, it needs to be protected. But in some cases, it needs to almost be rehabilitated after some crisis.
And do you think that college sports is in a crisis, or do you think that it's trying to really find what its future is going to be?
I think you hit on it earlier. Change is hard. It's really hard for humans. It's even harder for groups of humans as opposed to individuals. So I think we're in such a state of change that the risks of making a misstep are greater in this environment. So that makes it a critical juncture. And I also think as we delay or struggle to reach a definitive answer to status, which may take years in some cases, as you'll hear from from guests talking to us. But it really will be a place where I think that the end of this process, the end of this winnowing, we're going to have fewer schools that play sports at a higher level. We may be headed with a demographic drop coming up. We may have just fewer colleges. And so survival is sort of institutions is probably important here. And I also think survival of some sports in colleges, in the, maybe the Olympic sport model, is also important in this moment. I'd probably shock people if I suggested that there's concern, and it's been voiced by people at the NFL, of all people, that if college football narrows the number of schools that play it, that there won't be enough athletes in the pipeline to support a really vibrant NFL going forward. So it seems unusual that a pro league would suggest that consolidation of the sport would necessarily be bad, but the NFL is even watching that as a future. So I think there's a lot of, this is a moment fraught with peril. I don't know if a single misstep puts you out of it, but it's certainly a really complicated and perilous time where the stakes are high.
Now, through this very interesting period of change, you also just brought up that, you know, schools might, you know, close as well, not necessarily because of sports, but just because of economics and the amount of people wanting to go to university and or colleges, universities in general, and specific ones as well. I remember last year during the NCAA men's baseball tournament that one of the schools was closing. It actually closed, but the baseball team was still in their playoffs. You know, is that something that we may see, not necessarily a lot more of, but where we may see universities and colleges that were once big in the sports sphere are all of a sudden closing down, unrelated to the current uncertainties? It's just because of other economic factors.
Yeah, I mean, we have a fairly sizable demographic cliff that we're about to hit in this country in 2026. There were far fewer children born in the 2007, 8, 9, 10 range in the United States. And we haven't had a significant, contrary to some of the public conversations, we haven't had a significant influx of immigrants in that age range having children either. So our colleges have sort of depended on an ever-increasing number of inputs. In other words, kids who want to go to college in the traditional age. So our colleges are probably going to have consolidation and change. You can already see that happening now. Does athletics make you a survivor in that landscape, or being part of a vibrant athletic program, does it make you a survivor in that landscape? And I can't tell you there's direct correlation, but there certainly seems to be some connection between I'm in the right sports conference, I'm playing at a high level, my fans are interested in me, my alumni are interested in me, and I'm winning. I'm on the winning edge of that, as opposed to the losing edge of that. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right that the survival of institutions is at stake. So too is sort of the survival of the governing organization, the NCAA, that's been around for 121, 22, 23 years, whatever we count as their official start date, 1901, 1903, or 1905. It's been around a while, and its role and governance of college athletics is now being pressed by the marketplace to change and react. And the NCAA has been a particularly slow-moving, slow-reacting bureaucracy.
Now, speaking of the NCAA being a slow-moving, slow-reacting bureaucracy, do you think that it's the NCAA as an organization itself, or do you think that it's the members of the NCAA, all of the colleges and universities within the NCAA that are actually slow moving?
I think that's probably a bit of both. That the NCAA is a trade association, ostensibly a voluntary organization that has had a governance role and a marketing role inside of college athletics over a long period of time. Sometimes it's leading its members. Sometimes its members' fears are contributing to its inertia in some cases. But I think historically schools have moved a little bit faster than the NCAA have and are probably out in front of this right now, knowing what holds in the balance for them. The NCAA isn't running a track that isn't. The NCAA is not calling its own play or plays or running its own playbook, but it is sort of operating in a playbook that it's hard to stop because it is a big ship that takes a long time. And it sometimes takes change of direction, takes a long period of time. So the NCAA has had a lot of warning about the changes coming. It probably starts in, as we said, 1984 in the Board of Regents case. The NCAA has been on a pretty controlled retreat of its authority and its power and its influence over that over at least 30 years of that. But the last 10 or so, since the O'Bannon case in 2015, the NCAA is really does not have a lot of legal strength and does not have a lot of ability to defend itself the way it once did in court. And we're seeing courts, attorneys general, business relationships putting pressure on the NCAA to adapt more quickly. And that's so far been an adaptation that the NCAA has been not up to it, certainly in the timing. We now have the House settlement in front of us. That may put us in a slightly different situation, but if you're thinking about slow moving dinosaurs, colleges and universities are not the fastest, but the NCAA is a bigger, slower moving bureaucracy.
So who actually holds the power? And I'm not talking about the legal power, but the actual power within the NCAA. Is it the NCAA leadership itself? Is it conferences, or is it like the member institutions themselves? Because we all know it's not the athletes, right? The athletes have no power, but who?
We know the athletes have very little control and power, and their seeking control and power has been one of the key top things about this time, that the athletes want more rights, more say, more autonomy, and then maybe a larger share of the earnings of this. So all those are in play right now. Who's in charge? It's difficult to say. The NCAA is not like the NFL or the NBA, where there's a commissioner and there are clear stakeholders. It's a much larger association of 1,000 members. So there are voices that are magnified. As you say, conferences of voices are magnified because they hold a lot of money and a lot of influence. They have much closer communities or nexuses of interest. So there are some issues driving this. And then I think that the outside stakeholders, where the money comes from, are also driving this process. The participants, the institutions themselves, in many cases, are chasing that money, those opportunities and those glittery prizes to stay current and stay relevant. So it's a combination, and I don't think we've reached a common consensus of what that direction should be, who should be in charge of pursuing it. And again, that one challenge prevents us from thinking about the NCAA or college athletics as a single coherent enterprise the way we might about professional football or professional basketball.
So recently, you were a collegiate athlete yourself, correct?
I don't think recently is a fair statement of that, but I was a collegiate athlete myself. I wrestled and played football at Columbia.
If Robert Boland was an athlete today and not a few moons ago, what would the athlete be concerned about today as opposed to in the past? What would you as the athlete?
That's a great question, and I love the way you ask it because it requires both projection back and projection forward. I think athletes are mostly concerned about having a really good competitive opportunity at a place that cares about them and values them. What's changed in some measure is what the calculus of that care and value is. When I played, it was, can I have a little bit more financial aid? Can I have a little bit of assistance with, not necessarily my courses, but can I have a little more assistance with, can I use my gym credit this semester? Can I get a little greater time on the practice field or off the practice field to take care of my academics? All those things are issues. But I come from a really Victorian time compared to now. College athletics was a big business then. There were certainly teams that played with 50,000 or 75,000 people in their stadium on a regular basis. But it wasn't the intense television product that it is now. It wasn't a case where there was a coach making tens of millions of dollars. It was being played as sort of the historic view of it. It was being played for the joy and benefit of playing, as either as a co-educational value or a co-equal educational value, or a thing that's made the school special to build school spirit, and because we value the process. So I think the view has changed now that there's so much money in this sport, that it's now television product, that it's now league-based product. And what the athlete wants now maybe is a fairer share of that product and a little bit greater autonomy. I think I probably wanted a little bit greater autonomy. And I probably wanted to do well academically and have these academic opportunities and maybe a slightly lower cost. But I think now it's much more difficult. Athletes don't see the scholarship itself as valuable the way they once did, even though almost every adult I've ever talked to thinks that college is incredibly overpriced and very difficult. It's not a fair trade right now, and I think that they want to get some money for their service, their play that they render, but it's very difficult to comprehend what that is. And I kind of don't want the old version of me. I don't want to see college sports turned into a purely professional model. I want to maintain some value in the college relationship, the idea that you get this education that is unique, that is special, that has a benefit to you through the rest of your life, and even attendance at the institution has benefit to you for the rest of your life. I want to see some more focus back to that. So maybe I'm somebody trying to bridge two worlds that are not in concert anymore. But I'd love to see some connectivity between those two concepts. I mean, some quick thoughts. People with a bachelor's degree earn about 64% more over their lifetime than people without a bachelor's degree. People with a professional's degree even higher than that. You live a long, statistics sort of indicate people with degrees live longer, healthier, better lives than people without. Now, that's not to say that a degree is a meaningful be all and end all, but when the opportunity comes with that, it's a really neat benefit. The college scholarship program that the NCAA oversees is the second largest financial aid program in higher education, other than the GI Bill. It has a transformative effect on our public, and I think if we kind of allow that to simply become professionalized, and we forget the value of that, I think we're losing something pretty important. It's also an important training ground for our Olympic sport athletes, even though they're not paid as highly. But those sports are meaningful to the United States on the world stage. Having just come back from Paris and the Olympics, they're meaningful in the world as a substitute for statecraft, understanding other issues. So I think we're in a unique place that all those things are up in the air a bit in domestically, and certainly things that we need to think about.
So when you're looking at your past self as an athlete, you brought up autonomy, and one of the things you wish for in the past is that you had more autonomy. The lack of autonomy, does that correlate with potentially being an employee since you weren't autonomous and you didn't have the ability to do what you wanted? Is that one of the big arguments that's happening today in college sports?
Yeah, legally speaking, it is one of the there are 21 or so indicia of what creates an employee, as opposed to an independent contractor or a volunteer. But the idea that your lack of autonomy, the control that an entity, a coach, or someone has over you, is an indicia of employment. That master-servant relationship, as it's known in law. But the idea that you become an employee when these things happen. And I do think it's true that from the time that I played, now a lifetime ago, but when I played, there wasn't quite the same level of control. One, technology has increased the level of control and communication that athletes have. We didn't have a cell phone that we'd walk to from class. We couldn't watch plays and clips in our on our phone while we were walking across campus. But similarly, the coach couldn't talk to me. He couldn't send me notes. He couldn't make announcements. He couldn't have a. We didn't have a learning community. We didn't have a team chat. Weight workouts happened irregularly as opposed to regularly. So the idea that because of technology with technology, adjunct to technology, we see a lot more control over everything an athlete does, including swiping mm-hmm. in and swiping out of study hall and other things. So that's what, some of the things the courts have looked at in creating that employment relationship, and we're going to see more of that. And again, we do it for the performance, but we also do it because we have the ability to do it. And maybe there is a question as to whether that's really valuable. I'm a perfect example. I wrestled in college after playing football, not because I definitively needed to play a second sport, but I actually got much better grades. I was much happier when I was on a team playing than when I was out of season deciding how much beer and pizza I could have. My entire life had external organization. Yeah. So maybe I'm one of those people who'd be better in this externally organized world, but a lot of people feel over-organized and stressed because of it. And that's another challenge that we have here.
No, those are all great points that you bring up. And do you think that it's the legal issue that is the reason that there's so much pushback from the NCAA and the conferences and the member institutions? Or do you think that it's more ego-driven or just pushing back on change in general?
I think it's the unsettled nature of the legal status that causes the great bulk of the problems. And I think that what you pointed out is the pushback, just a resistance to change. There's some of that. But I think there wouldn't, if there wasn't so much up for change, then there wouldn't be as much resistance, if that makes
right.
sense.
So
I think the fact
sense.
That we have an ill-defined legal status in college athletics as to what the future of the athletes are going to be to their institutions and to their teams, that creates a really big stressor on the entire system. And the system then bends to try to protect that or keep an outcome. So I think we're causing ourselves some of this stress rather than just laying down the heavy rock to some degree.
Now, the last panel that we had for our annual leadership summit was talking about lawyers and the legal process through all this. I know you've talked a lot about it, you know, throughout this discussion today, but can you expound on that a little bit and explain more of why lawyers are incredibly important, you know, on all different sides of this situation?
Yeah, you know, it's a remarkable question. And the title of the panel was "Yes, There Will Be Lawyers." And that's a bow to a friend who teaches at Villanova Law School, who always says there will be lawyers to every conflict. Couple reasons why sports draws so much attention from the legal field is that sports has definitive winners and losers. And we don't always like that, winning and losing. So to some degree, we turn to the courts or we turn to the legal system to air our grievances, to redress our concerns. And then we had the third factor, it's a huge global business. So we depend on having a referee, in this case, often the courts or often lawyers. So and then every outcome in sports, we live and die over. We shed tears and blood and pain. It goes to our status. So I think we overemphasize that part of it. It we've turned some of our love of it into a divisive nature, but no doubt it's a huge business. It's a huge enterprise. It has probably more care and attention and affection and status than almost anything else that we look at. So the idea that lawyers are a natural byproduct of it. The college space, particularly, we've had lawyers in pro sports for 50 years in a variety of ways as agents and others making their living here. One of the reasons why the college enterprise has had so many lawyers is because it, because of its nature, that it doesn't enjoy the benefits of legal protection from not having employees, but also because it also operates as public interest in other ways. And when it gets off the public interest, that's another area for lawyers. Also, they're huge, the colleges themselves, in addition to operating big athletic departments in many cases, are a big business in and of themselves. They're in often cases, I think I looked at a list recently about a minority, but a significant minority in the teens, the largest employer in the state was a university. So we're only getting deeper into this world, not less deep into it. So yeah, I think that's one of the reasons, the unsettled nature, the idea that we also look at it so difficultly. And then I think we take so much of our identity as participants from it, that we don't want to take no for an answer. We think that things are biased or rigged. And so that's another challenge for us. So yes, there will be lawyers, took a look at all those issues. We looked at where lawyers kind of come into this. And I will say that one of the biases that I've picked up, and I'll confess my own, and we'll go from there. When I started to take the journey down this path in dealing with college athletics, I thought I was the only person who truly understood why college athletics needed to be protected, preserved as an academic and scholarship experience, but allowed to move toward a professionalized model and modernize, and everybody else was wrong. They all were wrong because they were biased. They were either inside the current model and didn't want it to change, or they were outside the model and wanted only their change. Right. The last 15 years of my journey down this, or 10 years for sure, as I've really journeyed down this model through teaching at Ohio University, where most of our students were, a lot of them were headed to be college athletic directors or in this larger college space, or through my time at Penn State, or now my time as a lawyer, I'm equally convinced that I'm absolutely right, and I'm the only person that understands this. But I'm also now believe that everybody wants only their solution. And I might be the only person now who's flexible enough to get to a compromise right. that we need. So that's probably a terrible thing to say, you're the only person capable of compromise. That's kind of kooky. But the idea that we have a lot of people out there fighting for their position and their solution, whether that's employment, whether that's non-employment, whether that's NIL only, whether that's some compensation, whether that's degree completion, whether that's no scholarships and only employment. I don't know if anybody really is willing to kind of take a holistic look, or very few people are willing to take a holistic look. And I have, in the last couple of years, found a few people who've done that holistic look. And I can also tell you, in some cases, what they were doing has often been kind of poo-pooed by others who wanted to only protect their own ox from being gored in that moment. So there was a lot of different factors happening here. It could take Congress to take a look at that. Except, what do we know about Congress right now? They're not really good at this either.
So, well, I mean, they're not really good at a lot of things. Like Title IX is a perfect example. Yep. I mean, how nebulous can Title IX be, and how short and generalized and not even informative? Like, you know, I mean, Title IX is, you know, I really hope, you know, even though what we're talking about with college sports is so incredibly important, I think, you know, personally, that Title IX should be corrected first before, you know, Congress even tries to tackle this.
Well, I think I'll expose a little bit of political bias here. I think the Biden administration has done a pretty good job of describing what Title IX has to be. They've said pretty clearly and unequivocally that when it deals with compensating college athletes, that it needs to be dollar for dollar even. And the NCAA, the major schools, have varied from that in the house settlement by looking back and picking a much larger retroactive share for the football players, a smaller share for men's basketball players, a still smaller share for women's basketball players, and then a equal share of the women's basketball team for all other sports. Mm-hmm. I feel like that actually goes against the direct spirit of Title IX. And I do recognize that's a case for back wages and back NIL earnings. So it's a little bit different than the forward-looking part. But I think a lot of schools are trying to say that that's how we should divide the forward-looking revenue. But I think Title IX is pretty clear. It's a dollar for a dollar on the men's side and a dollar for the dollar on the women's side if you're talking about compensation to college athletes. And that doesn't seem to me to be a particularly difficult format to figure out. Now, can you still have NIL exist separate from that model? Yeah, I think so. And can you still pay your teams? Yeah, I think so. So I don't know why we're all be treating that as a way, but maybe there's a recalcitrance or a resistance to recognizing what Title IX was supposed to be and what it is. But to me, I think it's pretty simple, and we still get that wrong a lot of the time. But I think it's mm-hmm. us getting it wrong. Now, Title IX's definition has changed a lot over the years, and we now have a more complex environment where the Supreme Court has allowed federal courts to interpose their own judgment over the meaning of the law, even over the agency. So it's not going to get easier, but it is, right. It is to me, I think Title IX is pretty clear. I also think Title VI, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which deals with race discrimination or race in higher education, similar to Title IX, is also a pretty clear statute. And I know a lot of schools aren't living up to that. So
exactly.
I think they're the easy ones. They're the forces of gravity that we should be hewing to, not trying to deny them for a different model. But when we do deny them, that also becomes a source of a lot of controversy and a lot of pain.
So one of the things that was lightly touched upon during the leadership summit, and I really hope that we talk about a little bit during this season of the podcast, is, are there any other entities in the United States that are like the NCAA?
I smile at that question.
You can answer legally. There are other
trade associations. There are other associations. There are other peer athletic organizations. There's a lot of stuff. I think the NCAA often defines itself for worse by what it says it's not. Mm-hmm. It's not a pro league. It's not a league of owners. It's not an organizational enterprise, but it certainly acts that way sometimes. It's not a governing organization, but it acts that way sometimes. In fact, I think the problem of it is definition. And I used to teach this in a class, but it's the Swiss economist slash philosopher Max Weber said, for an organism mm-hmm. to long survive, it needs to be simple and describable. And the NCAA is neither of those two things.
Exactly. Yeah.
It is a complicated idiot. On one point, it's a market participant. Another point, it's a governing organization. So it's a unique structure in the world in where it fits in. It now is getting unique antitrust treatment because it has no protections in the antitrust fight. It also is a unique, again, I think a uniquely maybe historic and in some cases arrogant structure, in the sense that it is hanging on to decisions it made as tightly as it can in spite of significant legal pressure and also just social pressure. The thing you talked about, just in my example, I'm a first generation Ivy Leaguer, big deal. That gets me on the subway if I have the subway fare and a Metro card. But I'm the first generation to went to a prestigious private university in my family. I'm the first lawyer in my family. And I went to a less prestigious law school in a variety of ways. More prestigious because I went there. But the interesting part about this is getting to the place I got to was a big win in my family and in the larger family that I was part of. But I'm from a two-parent home. My mother and father both worked. My mother had a public sector job that had a union in place, so she earned more than my father toward the end of my college career. I was a kid who thought himself upper middle class, and turned out I was only middle class. But I was sort of the norm of kids going to college and playing sports in college during my era. Maybe some were a little poorer than me, maybe a lot poorer, but it was much more people like me than not like me. Now, I think if you look at the people who are playing, particularly the big revenue sports in colleges, those people are much less like my background and much more on with a much more precarious social status. Now, I think a lot of people have more precarious social statuses right now, but I think their standing and status was much, much more precarious. And they're almost playing something pre-professionally, not like law, but football pre-professionally or basketball pre-professionally. And that's a really big change. And I think that does sort of require us to have some both empathy for their position, but also have some structure for what the purpose of the institution is too. How do we help this young person not just be a basketball player, but maybe be a doctor, or maybe be a geologist, or maybe be a teacher? And how does the university as an institution that didn't open easily to me as a 19 or 20 year old, and I was from a pretty privileged background, how does it open to a less privileged 19 or 20 year old who may not have had the same academic preparation I did? How do we help pathways for those institutions to support those people? And how do we keep those institutions vital and our society vital through that education?
Now, Bob, we have a incredible season for the Culture and Sports podcast coming up, and I'm really excited about it, and I'm super excited that you're involved as a guest co-host this season. And I ask this of every guest before the end of every episode, and I'm asking this of you as well. For this season, and for, you know, just for viewers and listeners and athletic directors, college presidents, athletes, parents, it doesn't matter who it is, but if there's one thing you could say to everyone, you know, or one thing you could say that everyone will remember throughout the season, what would it be?
I think that we said some of that in the summit, which, and this season tracks to some degree the topics we talked about in the summit, this changing environment of college sports. Recognize the change. Know that the practices that we dealt with or used a year or two ago may not be the ones that will carry us through the future. Inside that changing model, what are the things that we always will value at the end? We're going to value the competition. We're going to value the experience and friendship and opportunities we got. We're going to value the degree and the education that we receive, even if we change the timing of it, that you may receive it as you finish playing or after you're done playing in a larger percentage. We're going to value what our athletes' connection to our institutions are. So I think it's always coming back to the first principles of what are the nature of our relationships, what's the nature of what we do, and how do we provide those incredible opportunities to the future generation and remain relevant in light of these changing things. And I think we can never be relevant. You can never be relevant when you suppress change, and you can never be relevant when you deny change. There are two sayings from other forms. Former Army General Eric Shinseki used to always say, if you don't like change, you're going to like irrelevance less. And Ralph Peters, who's also a military historian, says the Shah always falls. And that may be a more complex statement, but things that are propped up and don't focus on the value of the people and the participants almost always fall under the force of change. So I think it's how do we value the people and the relationships and the quality of the purpose of what we do in a way that honors them and honors the people. And don't cast this as an athletes versus coaches, or coaches versus institutions, or institutions versus each other, and try not to take sides and balkanize in this, but think about this as a problem we all have to solve together.
And that's a wrap for this week's episode of the Culture and Sports Podcast. We hope that this episode has started an internal dialogue, or even one with your team, about the importance of leadership and organizational culture. If you'd like to learn more about Culture and Sports, the Culture and Sports Podcast, or other programs, go to cultureandsports.com, where there is a wealth of resources, articles, research, podcasts, video shows, webinars, and courses. And don't forget to connect with us on social media, on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, and LinkedIn at Culture and Sports, and on Twitter at Culture in Sport. Thank you for tuning in to the Culture and Sports Podcast.